Wake up call!
This is Wake Up Call,
another kind of daytime radio program.
A Gal Media property. Presented by Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Live from the O'Reilly Auto Parts studios. O'Reilly Auto Parts, better parts, better prices every day. Alongside Ron Culver, here's Tony D.
Wake up!
All right, thanks for joining us. It is Wake Up Call, SB Nation Radio. Find us on Twitter at Tony D Radio, at Ron Culver, that's Ron with two N's. If you've been watching The Last Dance and you're eight episodes in, the final two are coming up this weekend, you know one thing has been very clear. We've been saying this from the very beginning, which is this is a Michael Jordan-led documentary, right? He is allowing you a peek into the world that he has created, that you get to see what he wants you to see and described in a way that he wants to describe it. Are there angles to this documentary that go in other directions? Yes. Dennis Rodman's story, Phil Jackson's story, Scottie Pippen's story. You saw it when Scottie sat out of the last second play in the playoffs, Jordan's first year out of basketball. This documentary is trying to tell you the story of the Chicago Bulls from Jordan's arrival all the way to the last dance. But it is a Michael Jordan-controlled documentary. He runs the narrative, and that's okay because all documentaries do this. Look, when Ken Burns talks about how he has a problem with the footage Michael Jordan, you know, allowed to be filmed, to be used in this, and Michael Jordan's production company has been attached to this project, that is true, but all documentaries, even the ones Ken Burns makes, comes with some sort of bias of the storyteller. You're always shaping a story, right? And Jordan is shaping his story. That's why you're not getting real details into things that you might want more details on. The gambling has kind of been glossed over as I'm a competitive person. I could stop any time. And it's almost left at that without anybody else coming in and going, you know what? People who say that usually can't stop gambling. People say that as an excuse for their gambling. There wasn't really a ton of exploration into the baseball career. There was about the announcement. There was about the return to basketball. But there was a few quotes and some talking about training and his 13-game hitting streak. But you know what? There's a lot to that year in Birmingham where I think he grew as a person, where he struggled in a sport. But again, him and this director are shaping this story. But there's one in particular that I think was glossed over. It really needs to be examined for the truth, and that's next.
Listening to Wake Up Call, presented by Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Live from the O'Reilly Auto Parts studios, alongside Ron Culver, here's Tony D.
All right, thanks for joining us. It is SB Nation Radio. And again, you can hit us up on Twitter at Tony D Radio, at Ron Culver, and then again, Ron with two N's. So again, I've been enjoying this documentary a lot. I really have. And I think for me, it's a lot of it is a trip down memory lane of games I remember, moments I remember, defining moments of Michael Jordan's career. Stories behind the story I think are fascinating and awesome. The Bradford Smith story that was told in the documentary about how Jordan made up a slight so he could, you know, counter somebody's good game that he had against him in a back-to-back situation against Washington, I think was hysterical. There are also other angles and storylines that I didn't like. I don't like. I find it, even though it's been used to describe the competitiveness of Jordan and how awesome these moments are where he gets back at people, I think that some of the things that he is offended by and feels like he has to answer for are a little petty. And I also think it's not a good way to live your life when you all the time are just are looking to get revenge on people who did things you didn't like or said things you didn't like. I mean, the way this documentary frames it is if anybody had any confidence in their basketball game, Jordan took it as a personal insult and had to, you know, it's like, it's over and over and over again to the point of nauseous by it.
The narrative has changed, hasn't it? Because if you go back to when they played against the Pistons and they lost, He was able to say good game to him. And,
sure, right.
You know, congratulate them.
Yeah.
And then I think it was, you know, maybe it's the Pistons' fault. Maybe we can blame this on Isaiah as well.
Well,
since Isaiah didn't congratulate him after the what was it, the 91 series?
Yeah, the
91-92?
Yeah, 91 series, yep.
Yeah, 91 series. That because he didn't, because the Pistons weren't there, Isaiah didn't lead his team to say, "Hey, let's go congratulate the Bulls and wish them the best of luck." He took that upon himself to say, "Everyone who has a good game ever,
and
I will destroy."
I never understand, and I've been covering sports a long time. I've been in a lot of locker rooms, a lot of press conferences. I've talked to a lot of athletes one-on-one and in groups. And I still to this day, after all of these years, I don't accept the simplicity that so many of my colleagues do when it comes to, you now woken the beast. You, like, a championship isn't already the motivation for winning this. Like, they talk about the 96 finals against Seattle. Here's Michael Jordan coming back to the NBA, right? He's coming back. He's played baseball. He's now back. He comes back in midseason. They lose in the playoffs. So he goes into training camp with the goal of winning a title. But George Karl not saying hi to him in a restaurant, that's all he needed to put on a show against the Super. Like, if George Karl had stopped by and bought his dinner, Seattle had a chance. Like, what is that? What I'm supposed to take away from this?
Yep.
The George Karl going, he walked right past me, and Ahmad Rashad goes, then I knew right there. He was. How about this? How about we knew before the series even started that Michael Jordan was going to play really well?
All Jordan wanted was a simple nod, head nod.
Right.
George Karl could have just given him one of those little head nods, like, "Hey, man."
So Seattle, people in Seattle, you could have won this series had your head coach just said hi to Jordan, because Jordan would have just scored 13 points a game and, figured out whatever comes out of it was whatever comes out of it.
Why stop there? Seattle, you could have kept your basketball team.
Right, you could have kept your basketball team.
Had Jordan just given George Karl just given a little love towards Jordan.
Just a little wave. But it's everything with this guy. It's everything. A guy makes a good shot, fist pumps. Oh, now Jordan's got to go for 60. Right? It's everything. Yep. It drives me crazy.
You told me once before, I can't remember the guy's name again, for the Bullets.
Oh, LeBron James.
They were Washington Bullets. Then he put up 37, and Jordan goes, "I'm going to put that in the first half."
Right, in the first half, because he made up a slight that the kid came up to him, put his arms around him, and said, "Nice game, MJ," or "Nice game, Mike." And Mike, it was a made up story. He didn't even do it. And Jordan's generating that kind of. But here's one thing that I had to do a little research on, because when I watched it, I said, okay, that's not how I remember it. So the 1996 finals was between Jordan and the Bulls and Seattle Supersonics. And the Supersonics had Gary Payton on the team, who's one of the best defenders in the NBA.
Yep.
So he's one of the best. That's why he's nicknamed the Glove. He's one of the best defenders in NBA history, right, in terms of his defensive ability. So the storyline is that Seattle, they were down Nate McMillan, and Jordan was working against other players on Seattle other than Gary Payton until Seattle was down 3-0 in the series. And then George Karl, who was trying to get Payton more offensively than defensively because they were held to about 80-something points a game in their series against Utah to get to the finals, and he realized, look, against the Bulls, I'm probably going to need to score more. I need Gary Payton to be in another matchup. So he put other defenders on Jordan. The philosophy being, if Jordan can beat us, nobody else, we won't let everybody else do it. Well, it didn't work. And Karl had to change that strategy for game four in order to stay alive in the series. So Gary Payton's on Jordan, and he makes very difficult for Jordan in this series in games four, five, and six. Payton is talking about his defensive ability against Jordan in this series, just in this series, about how he really made it tough for Michael. They show Michael the video, and he laughs. And he goes, "I had no trouble with the glove." And it's left at that. No, he did have trouble with the glove. The statistics prove it. You won the title, no doubt about it. They won the title, and they won game six. But Jordan's numbers from game four through game six are significantly down than he had in the rest of the series or against any other team he's faced against real super defensive teams. You take the 88, 89, 90 Pistons, right? In those playoff series, Jordan averaged 27, 29, and 32 points a game against those Piston teams that were the toughest defensive teams Jordan faced. In games 4 through 6 in the 1996 against the Supersonics, once Peyton was on Jordan, how many points Jordan averaged in the series? 23 points. He was averaging 30 in the playoffs. Right? He shot 36% from the floor with Gary Payton guarding him. Now, I don't care how they spin it. Again, he won the championship, and in the end, that really does matter. In the end, that's the sort of, that's not just the cherry on the sundae, that's the whipped cream, the sprinkles, and the cherry on the sundae. So I absolutely acknowledge that. But this documentary blowing off as a joke Gary Payton's confidence that he did a good job against Jordan, as they all say that, but in the end, No, this was real. Gary Payton did a great job against Jordan in that series. They just didn't win. They were down by too many points. They were down by too many games. I remember George Karl when he came to the Nuggets. And we would talk about Karl, and we would talk about the Denver Nuggets would get to the playoffs, and they would lose in the first round all the time. And it was getting old after a while, and I remember people would call in, and they would say, yeah, it's George Karl, man. In the postseason, he can't do this. Look what he did in Seattle. Look what he did here. Look what he did there. And the Seattle was always brought up about how he mismanaged that series against the Bulls that could have been a better scenario. Maybe not a win, but a better scenario had he had a better strategy for Gary Payton in games 1 through 3. And that includes putting him on Jordan. This is an old NBA argument. This is an NBA argument that's been around a while. Did George Karl screw that series over for Seattle by not putting Payton on Jordan in the early part of that series? This documentary uses Jordan's narrative as the definitive truth. That's okay, because in the end, it's his documentary. But that's not the truth. The truth is the glove was an issue for Jordan in those 3 games. He just ended up winning the title, but those statistics are so different than what Jordan had in any other series that he had in the playoffs. There is a significant difference from when Gary Payton was on him to when anybody else was guarding him throughout the Eastern Conference playoffs and even in the early games against the finals. And it's one, and Gary Payton's performance against Jordan in those finals is some of the best defensive numbers anyone's ever put up against Jordan. And I understand that this is going to be about Jordan's successes and how competitive he is and how nobody stands a chance against him when he sets his mind to it. And you better be careful what you wish for, and you better not slight this guy or he'll put 60 on you. But don't gloss over this fact. Every now and then, I wouldn't mind if Jordan said, you know what? I really, I had trouble with him. He was really great. He did a phenomenal job. I struggled. I was shooting around 45% in the series, 47% in the series, or one series I was on fire, and he really troubled me with mismatches. He forced me to dribble onto different coverages, which is how Payton was so successful as a defender. He would guide you as a defender. He'd guide you to where you could get trapped. And that's what he was doing to Jordan, which is why Jordan struggled from the floor. So again, I remember watching a Muhammad Ali documentary, and one of my favorite moments in the documentary, and I think it was Sports Century when they did those, ESPN did those documentaries as we were heading into 2000. And I remember George Foreman, who was, a real adversary to Muhammad Ali, and all athletes have these egos, and Foreman, it may be a little different, but Foreman was talking about a fight he had with Ali, and he said, I'm in the ring, and I'm hitting him, and I'm hitting him, and I'm hitting him, and I'm just pounding him. I'm pounding him. He's against the ropes, and I'm pounding him. And he looks at me, and he goes, is that all you got, George? And I went, yep, that's pretty much all I got. That was so refreshing to hear. It was refreshing to hear a guy go, hey, I gave this guy everything I had, and you know what? It still wasn't good enough. Jordan has a hard time with this. He has a hard time saying, you know what? Yeah, they should have made that switch earlier, but they didn't, and we won the championship. it just, the idea that he laughs that Gary Payton feels like he had success in that series, the statistics show he had success in the, in those games in that series, and yet Jordan's laugh becomes the most memorable thing. And this is where my problem with it is. There's a generation that will look at that and say, ah, yeah, without doing the kind of statistical research going back and saying exactly what exactly happened in games 4 through 6 of the 96 finals, in which Payton did hold Jordan to just 23 points, way off of his playoff average, and 36% shooting. It's one of the things I wish this documentary would do just a little different. It does. You don't have to take away the superstar nature. You don't have to shine a different light on his success in the postseason and winning this championship, because winning the championship is the ultimate goal no matter what you shoot. You know, I'd rather go 1 for 10 in game 7 and win it than go 7 for 7 with 30 points and lose it. But at the same time, don't be lackadaisical with the truth at the expense of somebody who did their job. Because Gary Payton did his job. It just was too late. It was just too late, and he didn't have the help to close to win games early enough in this series to make it competitive, and they win in 6. And really, it's more fitting because that game 6 that was won in Chicago came on Father's Day. And it's more fitting to the larger story. So anyway, that was just my complaint. Anyway, on Twitter, at Tony D Radio, at Ron Culver, that's Ron with two N's, as we continue along at SB Nation Radio.
Wake Up Call with Tony D and Ron Culver continues now. Presented by Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Live from the O'Reilly Auto Parts Studios. Alongside Ron Culver, here's Tony D.
O'Reilly Auto Parts will make your auto repair, maintenance, and restoration projects easier. So when your car isn't stopping like it used to, hey, the professional parts people at O'Reilly Auto Parts will find you the parts and supplies you need to do the job right the first time. Now for a limited time, save 15% when you buy any set of Brake Best pads and 2 Brake Best rotors. Stop by O'Reilly Auto Parts today. O'Reilly Auto Parts, better parts, better prices every day. So don't get me wrong. I enjoy the documentary. I really do. I enjoy it. And I the stories are amazingly fun. They really are. Just want to make sure it's accurate.
Yeah, we get just a little bit more in depth on some of the stories, but I'm hoping I don't come away with watching the last 2 episodes just with that feeling of like, oh man, Jordan was just the most incredible player ever to play any sport ever.
Yeah. Well, can I ask a question here? Because I don't know this in terms of, maybe it's an industry thing where maybe you and I may be paying attention to it, but the average person isn't. But I kind of thought it was common knowledge that Jordan was going to have a hand in this documentary.
Yeah.
Because I've seen people say, oh, they took out Jordan's Jump 22 production company out of the credits and people need to know. I thought people did know. Am I missing? Was that not a thing? Do people not know that Jordan has a say in this? Look, he's not sitting down for all of these interviews going over every aspect of his life without some sort of creative content authority, right?
I mean, we all hoped this would be like the unabridged version of Jordan's life. Like, we got down to the dirt, the nitty-gritty. And I think that's what at the very beginning when we first saw this, like, oh, man, this is going to be hard-hitting. And it has been in some aspects. We've gotten to see a little bit more about Jordan's personality and Jordan's life, but we're not getting the seedy side of Jordan.
You know what?
I don't think we ever will.
One of the things I'd like to show, and they don't even have to do a very long period on it. They don't have to go into details it doesn't have to be like 20 minutes. Jordan missed a lot of critical shots. He talked about it in a commercial once. Remember where he said, "I've made this many, but I've missed this many." Like, he talked about how his failure would drive him to be successful.
Quote out there is like, you miss 100% of the shots you don't take.
Yeah,
isn't
something
that Jordan,
like that. Yeah,
or is that Gretzky?
Something along the lines. But he had a quote in, he would tell the story. He told this story in one of these Gatorade commercials, whatever commercials he was doing, about his failures, the times he didn't come through in the clutch, and it made him go to the gym to make sure that next opportunity. It was like an inspirational speech, right? I would have loved for them to do that, because it seems like every montage is just awesomeness. It's just, it would be nice if they went, and here's some of the reasons he was driven, because in his second year, he missed this shot against the Knicks, or he missed this shot against the Clippers, or whatever context you want to put it in, to show how he was driven to constantly make sure that that was never going to happen again. So when he does hit the shot against Cleveland, or he does hit other shots in other moments, that you could see some sort of, this is why I was at the gym, this is why I was first in, last out, those kind of things. But I'll tell you, the one, wasn't the Scottie Pippen story incredible? The when he sat out on that inbound pass because the play was called for Tony Kukoc. I mean, those of us who were around at the time remember that story, but to get the details of the locker room about, you know, Bill Cartwright crying, saying, "Man, you let me down. You let down the team." And people realizing, Scotty, you don't realize how big this is. We're in the playoffs, and we had a last-second play drawn up, and you quit, and you sat down, and you didn't want to go in the game. And now we've got a problem, because it's the postseason, and if we are now going to be tearing each other apart, this is not the time to be doing this. What I found interesting about that was, afterwards, Scotty realizing how oh, this is a problem. This isn't, I'm not going to come out of this one good. But he even said afterwards, like all these years later, he said, you know, if I had to do it again, I don't think I would have done it differently. I would hope you would do it differently if you had to do it all over again. That's part of having to do it all over again, is that you have more information about it so that you don't make the same mistake twice. I mean, sometimes we grow during a mistake so much that we say, you know what, without that in my life, without that pitfall in my life, I wouldn't have become this. And so, yeah, I would have gone through it all over again if it meant I was going to be a better father, or I was going to be a better husband, or I was going to manage my money better, or I was, right? I would gladly go through this situation, big or small, to make me a better person. Scotty had a situation where he made the wrong decision, the teammates rallied against him, his coach rallied against him and said, this is unacceptable. This is unacceptable as a professional athlete for you to decide to sit out on a last second play when your team needed you the most, when we're fighting for our lives in the playoffs. And then Scotty goes, I don't think I'd do it again. Oh, I hope you would.
I mean, that'd be like a criminal going, man, if I'd known I was going to spend the rest of my life in jail, you know, I may not have murdered that guy, but if I had a chance to do it all over again, I wouldn't change a thing.
And I think it was Jordan that even said it, and it's true. We see Scottie Pippen, one of the greatest basketball players of all time, champion, right? Robin to the Batman, all of the things that we talk about Pippen. But we also still talk about this. There is still that moment.
Yep.
Where there's still that part of his legacy that has not been erased all of these years later. And Jordan said it, where he said, I knew he was never going to live that down.
Well, there's two negative things that always surround Pippen. It's that, you know, that he quit on his team. Because, you know, in 98, he kind of did the same thing, holding out for a new contract.
Right, exactly.
You know, which we understand that, yeah, you know, we understand why you're holding out for a contract. But at the same time, you know, a lot of us don't understand, because we never have the opportunity to sign $1 million contract. The other stigma that always stuck with him forever is no tipping Pippen.
Yeah, that's true. That's right. Yeah.
We all know how cheap he is.
It's true. That's true. But he also, you know, that situation with the contract is couple where you have people saying, yeah, you know, he should have handled this in the offseason. But there were other players who said, this is the only leverage you have.
Yeah.
Right. So there are players on his side. But I don't think there's anybody. I don't think anybody in the NBA would say, yeah, no, that's cool. Last second play, drawn up for another player, and you get hurt and you decide not to go into the game. And like at that moment when your team needs you on the floor, you just give up and you just quit in the middle of a fight.
Yeah.
Like, I don't think anybody in the league would have said, no, that's cool, I understand that.
You let your teammates just hang out there?
He's on an island by himself on that one, completely on his own, completely, utterly on his own. And to this day, you're right, it's still one of those memories that he's got to live with. It's still one of those issues he's got to live with. And maybe he handles it better today and doesn't really care. Or maybe it's one of those where he goes, man, I wish I didn't do that. I was young and stupid and I was hurt. And
that's all you
got
to say. That's what we wanted you to hear.
That's
not
right.
That
just say,
I would have done anything different.
Just say, man, that was the dumbest thing I've ever done. And then we go, yeah, that's great. We accept it.
You're listening to Wake Up Call, presented by Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Live from the O'Reilly Auto Parts studios, alongside Ron Culver, here's Tony D.
All right, again, thanks for joining us. It is Wake Up Call, SB Nation Radio. You can find us on Facebook at Wake Up Call with Tony D and Ron Culver. Like us there. You can leave us a message. Love to hear from you. All right, so we found the Jordan. I was talking about the Jordan commercial where he talks about his failures and makes him driven. If my memory is correct on this, it might be a little gray.
No, it was spot on.
Was it spot on? Oh, thanks. Yeah. Nobody really says that about my memory sometimes.
No, you're not that old yet.
All right, so here is the ad I was talking about.
I've missed more than 9,000 shots in my career. I've lost almost 300 games. 26 times I've been trusted to take the game-winning shot and missed. I've failed over and over and over again in my life. And that is why I succeed.
Yeah, see, that's what I was talking about, right? Those moments, I would love a segment of this because, you know, one of the cool things about this is that it can be a real learning tool for a lot of young athletes to watch the drive that this guy has, but you can get lost in his one-of-a-kind greatness, his one-of-a-kind talent, his once-in-a-generational talent, but he doesn't shy away. He doesn't say, look, I do have this gift, but my God, do I work at it? Do I work at it? And I work at it because I've failed. And if you just have this moment where it's not preachy, but it's enough to sort of say to somebody, hey, you know what? He didn't make every shot. I know these montages are cool, but he didn't make all his shots. And that's what drove him to be one of the greatest basketball players of all time. If you just had that element in the documentary where it's not just this big puff piece of excellence, it is, yep, and he missed these shots, but my God, did it propel him to the gym at 5 o'clock in the morning. You know, Tiger talks about that all the time. Tiger always talks about the tournaments he lost, where he wasn't in contention, the majors that he didn't win, as why he would get up at 5 o'clock in the morning and go to the gym. It's the great ones have a tendency to do that, and if you showcase that, if you could just showcase that in this documentary a little bit, I think it goes a long way to give you the entire picture of Jordan. Because it's one thing to say the greatest basketball player on the planet goes, you know, works out all the time and practices all the time and works on his game all the time. That's great, but when you talk about it, well, here's a couple of reasons why he does it. He's driven because he wants to be successful, because he wants to be a champion, but also because here are the moments where he failed. And it drives him not to fail again. I think it's a good lesson. And it goes. It's one of those things with baseball when we talk about him going down and playing in his baseball career and the people talking about whether or not he'd be a major leaguer. It is hard to... One thing that Michael Jordan could not do, right? It's the one thing he could not do no matter how many times he got to that ball field and did batting practice and worked out and... When you are an 18-year-old kid out of high school and you go to the minor league system, okay, when you start out at single A and double A and you move up, you are absorbing all this information constantly. You see pitch after pitch after pitch after pitch daily, and you do it for years and years and years. Jordan was trying to make up for lost time, right? I mean, Jordan is 31 when he goes to play baseball. He doesn't have 13 years or 12 years of seeing pitches as he grows as a baseball player. So he's fighting father time and experience, and he's trying to marriage both of them into a baseball career. That's why when Terry Francona says, well, with 1500 at bats, I could see him being a major leaguer. He's trying to get all of that crammed in. At what point does age for that particular sport take over and Jordan can't get there? Like he just ran out of time. Because it does take experience. Now, some kids get it right away. Some kids go right because they just they're just naturally gifted. But some do have to see a number of breaking balls, do have to see a number of fastballs, sliders, changeups, things like that, hitting in certain situations to sort of establish themselves as a ball player and growing. Jordan was fighting all of that. He was fighting everything. So that's I'm more skeptical of that he could have made it to the majors than most other people. The caveat to the skepticism is, in a lost season, would the White Sox have brought Jordan up as a September call-up in year three, right, if he had stuck with it? Yeah, I could see that. I mean, I could see Reinsdorf doing that, right? I mean, so do I think straight up against the best of the best of the best, he could be one of the best of the best that deserved a call-up? I'm more on the no side.
Yeah.
On the, could it have been just something Reinsdorf did a couple of years down the road? Like, not right away, but down the road. Okay, I could see that.
What's the difference between him and Tebow?
Well, that's a good question.
In this situation.
In terms of having popularity /
Drawing power. Us just, people wanting him to be in the major leagues just because.
Right, right.
Not for skill wise. I mean, almost as a way to, like, I guess, like, you know, debunk the whole system of the minor leagues, league system. Like this is why this is a joke. You know, we know that Tebow was close to getting there on his own merit. You know, what was that, 2 summers ago? But ended up having a broken wrist. I mean, he was actually playing well.
He was in the Double A All Star game.
Yeah. Probably would have had a good chance of, obviously going up to AAA, but good chance of just having a call-up just because the Mets had nothing else going on for him.
Now, the White Sox, the year he announced his retirement, were in the playoffs.
Yeah.
So they were pretty
good. Did they make it
to
the series? The following year?
No.
Because they made it around. Oh, no, they didn't make it in the 90s at all.
No, 2005, they made it to the World Series, won the World Series.
As a Guillen.
So in the mid-90s, I think they were pretty decent enough to thwart off any idea that they would be, like, en route to a 100-loss season and Jordan could be called up in September. But,
yeah.
I don't know. I mean, who knows what turn of the card that could have been. But it's all, and this is not, and again, to say this is to not criticize the work ethic. It's to just say, look, you're fighting against something that's working really against you, right? You're just not going to be seeing the amount of pitches that you're going to need to make up for the 12 years you were away from the sport. And that's, no matter how hard you work and show up and do the drills and all that,
and
you're not going to get enough real live at-bats to warrant, at 31 years old, a push ahead people who are climbing up the ladder behind you.
And that's what I'm wishing or wondering. Did Terry Francona say anything like that? But they edited it all out and go, no, if he had 1,500 right. at-bats, he would have made the majors.
Right, yeah, exactly.
And that's where, like, when I saw that, I was like, okay, is this more like, it's a Jordan documentary, but are we, celebrate? Is it just going to be about how great of a person and player he was?
Right, right. And I mean, listen, it's like when my daughter's progressing through her basketball in high school, and she's going to be a sophomore, and I tell her all the time, I'm like, you may look at the people ahead of you that are leaving, but you also got to look at the people behind you that are coming up, right?
Yep.
Like, you've been waiting to be a starter on this team as you were a freshman. You got playing time. You're going to be a sophomore. The belief is you're going to start, but you don't know who's coming up behind you. Like, you don't know who the freshmen are going to be. You don't know who's transferring in. You don't know who's moving here. So you never have to stop working, because it's not a guarantee when you finally reach that first practice. Jordan was going to deal with the same thing in baseball. It's not so much looking around the landscape and getting enough at bats and getting enough reps. Who are the prospects that are coming up? When you only have a certain number of call ups, is there somebody coming up through the ranks that is taking those spots away? So there's a lot more to this than just hitting a certain number and then going to the pros, right? Like, that's not how it works. Like, you don't get to go, well, if you magically hit 275, you get to check into that punches your ticket into the major leagues. I mean, there's a whole bunch of circumstances behind it. Does Jordan's name, would have it, probably, right? Who knows? Straight up, no.
No, because I can't.
I just can't see it. I just can't see it.
I can't imagine someone with a batting average of 202 who is a decent outfield. I don't even know if he was a decent outfielder. A competent outfielder batting 202 gets the call up to the majors.
Yeah, exactly.
You're batting 202 in Double A. That means you're not seeing pitching. You know, you're not seeing better pitching, and then you're definitely not seeing elite pitching. What would you be hitting then? You're gonna be hitting.
Right.
Would you be hitting anything?
You ever work with somebody who has kind of got a reputation for being a jerk?
Right? Every then, morning,
right? Yeah. Thank you. But everybody goes, but he's a really nice person.
Exactly. Right?
Yeah. Well, why do they do that? Why do they do that? Because the immediate perception is he's not, right? Like the immediate perception when people go, but he's a really nice guy. He's a really nice guy. Oh, no. He's a sweetheart. It's because when you originally meet him, he doesn't give you that. This is what Michael Jordan's 202.50 RBI thing is, right?
Yeah.
Jordan's 202.50 RBI thing is, yeah, but there were some other people that didn't even drive in 50 runs. And, oh, that 202, he actually got better as the season was progressing. Like, if Mike Jones from Asheville, North Carolina was betting 202 with 50 RBIs, you'd go, hey, kid, you really need to work on it a little bit more. Like, you need to get to the batting cage, and we need to work on some things. That's not going to cut it.
Or you knock him down.
Right.
You knock him down to single A. If you're in Double A, you knock him down to single A. If you're in single A, you're like, you know, you're not starting him.
But a 31-year-old NBA superstar trading in his shoes for baseball cleats and changing his whole body to work out to play in Double A baseball, that's impressive. That's like, hey, that's pretty good. That's not bad. That's better than most people. Like, if I got Joe Montana in here, let's say he quit playing football, and let's see if Wayne Gretzky quit hockey and came into the Birmingham Barons, they'd probably do worse. So congratulations, former NBA champion superstar. You did pretty good here in this baseball experiment. But a kid who was drafted out of Long Beach High School that was gone through, you know, some rookie ball playing in Double A for Birmingham, no, he would have a career track that would be, we got some work to do. He's got to go back to, you know, middle of nowhere Iowa or something like that. That's just the way it's going to have to be. And those are two different perceptions, right? Those are two different ways of looking at it. Because on the one end, you could celebrate the incredible achievement, which is really incredible. I mean, to be honest with you, for a guy that didn't play baseball since high school, like Tebow made an all-star team, but he'd been in the minor league system a year before, so he was getting his feet wet into it and whatnot. Jordan just went boom, boom, and batted 202, drove in 50 runs, had a 13-game hitting streak at the beginning of his career before they started throwing off-speed pitches, and here we go. Digestible as an NBA superstar, of course. Not so much if he was a legit come-from-the-bottom-up prospect. These are comparing two totally different things. All right, again on Twitter, at Tony D Radio, at Ron Culver, Ron with two N's. As we continue along, it's hour three of SB Nation Radio.
You're listening to Wake Up Call. Presented by Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Live from the O'Reilly Auto Parts Studios, alongside Ron Culver, here's Tony D.
All right, thanks for joining us. It's SB Nation Radio. This hour is brought to you by Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Rocket Mortgage with you every step of the way to provide a seamless mortgage experience. All right, getting off the Jordan documentary for a second, my hat's off to a Rob Ferguson. He wanted to climb Everest, but it was postponed due to the coronavirus, so he took to walking up and down a flight of stairs. 24 hours and 30 minutes. He did it 6,506 times up and down those stairs to match the equivalent of climbing Mount Everest. Obviously, the views were not the same. Obviously, the danger was not the same, but he did it anyway. God bless you, man.
Where were the stairs?
Incredible. The stairs were in an apartment in England.
Wow.
Isn't that incredible?
Yep. Now, is he hoping to raise $10 million like the World War II vet?
No, but he did want to. He zoomed it and filmed it, you know, to raise some awareness.
Nobody's giving him $40 million.
Yeah, he said he got a lot of blisters. Well, yeah, I think you would. 6,000 times walking up and downstairs.
I would give up.
Me too.
I'm going to be honest with you. I mean, I think it's an amazing feat, but after doing it about 20 times, I'd be like, oh, this is just ridiculous.
Yeah, if you do it 20 times and you realize you have 6,551 more times to do it,
yeah,
Wouldn't you say that's enough?
Well, I mean, but what do you... I guess I'm just struggling with the fact of I would be doing it knowing this isn't Everest.
Right.
You know, am I now... It's like, you know how people always claim that, you know, this is the Everest of cooking or this is the Everest of that because it's, you know, the pinnacle, the peak.
Right.
Is he the Everest of stair climbing now?
I guess so.
Walking up and down. What about, he said it's an apartment building?
Yeah. So he had to be quiet, he said, because he didn't want to wake people up when he was doing it in the middle of the night.
Yeah, what about people who, you know, who are walking back and forth?
Yeah, just walking with him going, please move. Yeah. Can you please? I got to get to work. What are you doing? By the way, if you had a year to train and no worries about work or anything, would you do Everest? Would you train to climb Everest?
Nah, I don't think so.
I've never had a desire for that.
Nah, I haven't either.
There are people who are like, I got it. Like, people do it once and they couldn't make it to the top because, you know, they got so close and was called off because of weather. And they go, I'm coming back. I got to get back. I'd be like, nah, I tried it. I'm out. I mean,
I don't think I'd get that far.
I'd just be like, I might get to base camp and go, okay.
Yes, at the base camp, go, man, you know what? I can't breathe here.
So, when I lived in Colorado, people loved mountain climbing. Mountain climbing was never my thing. I never wanted to do it. I never wanted to learn how to do it. Or I just thought, I respect people who, but I just never, don't want
to
do it.
No,
plus, those dead bodies on the mountain would freak me out.
Oh, yeah. You just walking by one and you're just like, you're supposed to just casually be like, oh, yeah, there's Tom.
Yeah, they're like, we can't get these bodies. It just there's no way to get them, so we just leave them here for you tourists to come by and we leave them in the jackets and the gear that they were in, and you know, that's it. There they are.
Just realize the sacrifice that they're making.
That's right,
for you.
I think I'd be freaked out by that because there's really nothing like that in the world, is there? Like,
no,
you don't play Pebble Beach and go, yeah, but when we get to 16, there's about four or five dead golfers who had heart attacks and we just left them on the course.